Today's podcast is brought to you by Tape-A-Call, a super valuable tool for journalists and professionals looking to record crystal clear calls on their smartphones. We spoke to the folks over at Tape-A-Call and learned that it's actually the number one business app for the iPhone in over 30 countries. Tape-A-Call lets you easily record your incoming and outgoing calls, as well as share your recordings with colleagues, interviewees, and through social media. It's the perfect tool for recording phone interviews. Tape-A-Call keeps people honest and accountable and ensures that you never miss an important detail for a story. Over 3 million professionals, including local news journalists and even CNN producers, trust Tape-A-Call on a day-to-day basis. Visit tapeacall.com/podcast today and experience the easiest, most reliable, and convenient call recording app available. It's All Journalism listeners can get Tape-A-Call at an exclusive 20% off discount by visiting tapeacall.com/podcast.
He said straight up, you know, I have different standards than you do for what I have to put out there. And I also know more. Like he says he knows more that verifies that this is actually the case, that she had his love child. The problem is we don't know that. I haven't seen a birth certificate. I haven't seen any evidence that she gave a child up for adoption, let alone that it was this sitting U.S. senator's child who is in a very contested race and who has a lot of people who don't like him who are trying to make sure he doesn't win.
Welcome to It's All Journalism. My name is Michael O'Connell, here with another podcast. And this time we've got sort of a little special treat. Julie O'Donohue, our station chief from the New Orleans and Baton Rouge desk, is actually in studio. She's in town for the holidays, you know, hanging out with her family, and she decided to come by the studio, and we're going to just have a little chat about the work she does for the New Orleans Times-Picayune.
Yep.
And she also, you live in Baton Rouge, and your primary beat is covering the State House. And I believe that there were a lot of things going on in Louisiana this last year, election-wise.
So I work for the New Orleans Times-Picayune and NOLA.com. I primarily cover the state legislature and the governor. And we had a governor's race this year that wrapped up in late November, right before Thanksgiving. And it was surprising because a Democrat won. There aren't that many Democrats in the South. And I believe John Bell Edwards, who is our governor-elect, will be the only Democrat governor in the Deep South. So Terry McAuliffe in Virginia is a Democrat. And then the Kentucky just threw out their Democrat governor, but they did have one. But I think we are the only Democrat governor in the Deep South.
Yeah.
So that was surprising. He won pretty handedly, 12 to 13 points. I'm not really sure what the last total was. And that was a surprise. I don't think that anyone would have said, well, anyone outside of his camp would have said 6 months ago that they thought that he would be the governor-elect right now. He's a state rep. So he's a very sort of low-level state government official. I mean, he doesn't represent that many people. He's a Democrat, a white Democrat from a rural part of the state. They're sort of like unicorns. They're kind of dying. So there were a lot of factors that were working against him, or so we thought, but he ended up winning. And there are a lot of reasons for that.
So at the same time while this was going on, you had a governor, current governor, who was
running for president.
Yeah,
our current governor is Bobby Jindal. He was running for president. I have to say, from our standpoint, we just kind of chose to, I won't say ignore that, because we covered it a little bit, but it wasn't our primary responsibility. He has retired, but we had a Washington correspondent who was doing a little bit of that, but and I was doing a little bit of it with my coworker Kevin Litton, who also covers the State House. But for the most part, we decided we were going to focus on the governor's race
because there was plenty of stuff. Mm-hmm. Now, who are the two? Well, The last time you were in here, you talked a bit about the sort of odd way that the right. Louisiana does its elections.
Right.
It has to do with it's like a big mass primary. Right.
Yeah. So in Louisiana, in the primary, well, what they call the general, but probably what we would consider the primary, everyone runs against each other in one large group. So like Democrats and Republicans. So we had four major candidates running against each other. We had the Democrat, John Bel Edwards, who won. We had the lieutenant governor, who was a Republican. His name was Jay Darden. We had the public service commissioner. The public service commission kind of regulates utilities and does stuff like that. Scott Angel, he was running. And then we had a sitting U.S. senator named David Vitter, conservative guy, somewhat like Ted Cruz, running. And they all ran against each other. And if one of them had gotten over 50% of the vote, which happens when you have an incumbent usually, then the election would have been over. Okay, you've gotten 50% of the vote. If no one gets 50% of the vote, the top two vote getters go into a runoff. And in this case, John Bell, the Democrat, was almost assured to get into the runoff because he, you know, there aren't, well, we didn't think there were that many Democrats in Louisiana, but you get a solid 30-35% of the vote that's just yours to have. And so when there were three other Republicans, it's hard for them because they're all duking it out for...
Sure, for the same
Space. If there had been two Republicans and a Democrat and they were splitting 30-30-30, we could have had two Republicans in the runoff, but we had three big ones running. Yeah, and the long and the short of that is John Bell ended up getting 42% of the vote. He did really well in the primary, much better than Democrats have been doing with white voters in Louisiana for a while. Louisiana has a large black population, so about 30% of the electorate is black, and so they tend to vote Democrat. So, you know.
Sure.
But the David Vitter, the U.S. senator, who everyone had thought would be the governor and whose strategy, everyone's strategy in this election on the Republican side was get me in a race with the Democrat and I will just kill him because I am the Republican with the R behind my name. So his strategy for sure, David Vitter's, was I want to be in a runoff with John Bel Edwards because if I'm in a runoff with Scott Angel or Jay Darden, I'm in trouble. And we can talk about why that is. But He only got like 22% of the vote, but he was the other two split their portion of the vote was smaller. So he ended up being in the runoff with John Bell. And John Bell wanted him in the runoff because John Bell thought either the other two Republicans were stronger candidates. And the reason David Vitter, well, there are a couple of reasons, but the main reason that he is a vulnerable or was a vulnerable candidate is he was caught up in the D.C. Madam scandal in 2007. Mm-hmm. He never, I guess, directly admitted to seeing prostitutes, but he was found to be in contact with the D.C. Madam. And he came out and had a press conference and said he had a serious sin that he committed. And, you know, his wife spoke about leaving their family alone, and then they tried to never speak of it again. And in 2010, he ran for the U.S. Senate again. This came up, you know, no one...
Batted an eye.
Well, I mean, people batted an eye, but he won pretty handedly. And so I think he thought heading into this gubernatorial election, that was always kind of the end game. He wanted to be governor. I think he thought, you know, things would be okay.
Yeah, and I imagine in 2010, his strategy was to run against Obama and Obama's policies.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so now it's, you know, a few mm-hmm. years later, he's mm-hmm. he's running for the governor, and I think that was probably part of his strategy this time around.
Yeah, it was a big part of his strategy. A few things happened. You know, you have other Republicans in the race, and so he ran as the front runner, which means you don't participate in as many debates. He didn't participate in debates. He would be upset about this if I said this, because there were dozens upon dozens of candidate forums that he did participate in. But many of those were ones where he got the questions in advance.
Sure.
And he kind of was able to control at least what was asked of him, if not the other candidates who brought up prostitution a lot. But he didn't participate in the debates, and I think that might have backfired on him. We think those things don't matter, but when you're having televised debates and there are three people on stage and two of them are Republicans, you know, it begins, and they're all beating up on you, because even John Bell, who wanted him to win win on the other side because it was better for John Bell, he, I mean, they all sat up there and trashed him. I mean, the other aspect is not only do you have this prostitution scandal, he's just not very well liked. He tends to maybe not be very nice or warm to people, I guess would be the better way, and so of saying it. So, you know, people, I don't know that in the inner circle of state government that people, the current governor really, really doesn't like him. I don't know that he was well liked. He was well liked by people who like him. He's smart, very smart and capable and stuff like that. But he's not afraid to say when he doesn't like someone or thinks that they have a dumb opinion. And he will say that, you know, publicly and pretty caustically. So he let, during the primary, people get up on statewide television and just trash him, you know, because he wasn't participating. And I'm not sure that that was, like,
right
in the end, the right way to go. Yeah. So
do you think that was a lot of, it was the prostitution scandal and then his lack of warmness and his sort of allowing the opposition to sort of build up this, you know, paint, basically control the narrative of who he was?
Yeah, I mean, I think actually also Citizens United played a role in this. So the PAC that was supporting, so for people who don't know, campaigns in Louisiana and many other places, not everywhere, but many other places. In Louisiana, there are contribution limits on campaigns. So if I'm giving a David Vitter, I can only give $2,500. And maybe my spouse can give $2,500, you know, but that's it. But with the Citizens United, the Supreme Court case, not only is it affecting the presidential race and allowing, like, very wealthy people, basically Citizens United said, well, I'm simplifying this, but there are these groups called PACs, and you can give as much money as you want to them because it's a freedom of speech issue, but they can't coordinate directly with a campaign.
Right.
So as we've seen in the presidential race, where, like, you know, Jeb Bush has raised like $100 and some million, or a PAC supporting Jeb Bush has raised $100 and some million just to get him elected. We saw that in Louisiana for the first time this year, and it was mostly spurred by David Vitter. He went to the Louisiana Supreme Court, or I'm sorry, someone supporting him did, and said, we have this PAC, and because of Citizens United, we want state law, the state law that limits how much people can give, to be, you know, stripped, basically. Mm-hmm. His PAC, which was called the Fund for Louisiana's Future, went and fought for the $100,000 cap, I think, to be basically done away with. And it was thought at the time, man, he's the only one who can raise that type of money. He's a sitting U.S. senator, you know, whatever. Well, what ended up happening is a couple of different groups sprung up that just were anti-Vitter groups. They were not interested in, like, supporting John Bell or supporting Jay Darden or supporting. They just popped up to raise lots of money, mainly from trial lawyers in the state, to bring to light his prostitution scandal on TV. So there was something called the Gumbo Pack that did that. And then there was another one that was literally just like this guy's law firm. He just went out and created a pack and dumped probably like $1 million of his own money into running ads, talking about how David Vitter had been seen with prostitutes. So in addition to the campaigns attacking him and their own, all those candidates had their own packs. John Bell's was more on a positive message for a lot of reasons during the primary. He knew he was getting into the runoff, so he didn't really have to go negative.
Sure.
But, you know, they had all these people attacking him, so it was kind of funny. I do think prostitution was a big reason, but I think the reason it got out there so much and was up on, you know, we're watching like the Alabama-LSU game and there's like prostitution ads running, is because these groups could raise unlimited amounts of money. And so people who really didn't like him could draw attention to this scandal.
So, and but they weren't particularly aligned with any particular candidate.
No.
They, but it was just attack, attack, attack. So that the so that his opponent didn't have to really right. do say anything negative, just sort of paint himself right. as the, you know, the alternative.
Right. They did, but yes.
So that's weird. You know, you're covering the state house, you're covering the elections, you know, what was your experiences sort of covering these races?
Well, that's interesting because from a journalism perspective, something very interesting happened during the race. So as I said, David Vitter fairly well admitted that he saw prostitutes. In 2007, when that came out, Hustler paid a woman in New Orleans to do a spread in their magazine who had said that she had been a prostitute that he had seen and to write about it. I believe Larry Flynt at Hustler put the call out and said, if you know of a family values conservative that, you know, saw a prostitute, this is around DC Madam time. I want to write about, you know, if you were a prostitute. I think he was like, I want to write about this. So, and expose these, in his mind, hypocrites. So, this woman who had worked as a prostitute in New Orleans came forward and said, David Vitter was a client of mine, and she told Hustler a story and did a spread for them and got paid a lot of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars, but I don't remember how much. She also talked to my newspaper at the time and told a very similar story. She saw him for a few months. He was really cold. There was lots of graphic details about how he disposed of condoms and things like that. And, it was a consistent story between what she told Hustler and what she told our reporters at the time. In this campaign, he had to address it more directly. So he's never admitted to seeing prostitutes in New Orleans. He's really only, you know, kind of.
So he doesn't support local industry is what you're saying.
Right. So I tell all that backstory to say there was a local blogger. There were a number of local bloggers who were looking into trying to find new evidence about him and prostitution because it was thought for a long time that these old stories weren't going to sink him. So we need new information. And a blogger in the New Orleans area named Jason Bradbury, who has written about a variety of things, he hooked up with a private investigator / bounty hunter, who is an ex-cop who was paid by a businessman to work on David Vitter prostitution things. He won't say who paid him, but he tracked down the prostitute who had come forward, who's changed her name a bunch of times, who had come forward for Hustler and for us in 2007. He found her, I think, in Texas, but maybe in Louisiana. And she was telling a different story that involved having David Vitter's love child, that involved being a kept woman in the French Quarter, that he was paying her $5,000 a month, that they had had some sort of relationship for years, that he, when she became pregnant with his love child, he had asked her to have an abortion. It was a pretty crazy story. Yeah. And the blogger went with the private investigator and he's a videographer by trade. That's what he does in his life. Mm-hmm. Went and interviewed her and put these interviews up on his blog saying, you know, David Vitter has a love child and it was given up for adoption. And here's Wendy Ellis saying all these things. So from a journalism perspective, I'm a member of the mainstream media. That starts posing a problem. You have a blog. This is not, you know, we're not talking about Gawker. This is not someone with a huge reach, but nevertheless, someone who has video of a woman saying, David Vitter tried to force me to have an abortion and I had his love child, you know, in the middle of the campaign. And it was a difficult decision to try to figure out what to do with that. People handled it differently in our market. Because I guess I should go back and say her story was highly questionable. Not only was she telling us something completely different than she told us before, no one could ever really tell me, including the blogger himself, who definitely believes her and thinks that she is telling the truth, and says that he's seen other evidence that this child exists, but we have not seen that evidence. No one could ever really tell me, including the private investigator, and I'll speak for myself, that she wasn't paid. So that's a big...
Paid by who? By the blogger? By somebody who the guy was hiring the investigator?
I don't think the blogger has the money to pay her. Sure. But for like someone who doesn't like...
or something.
Yeah, David Vitter. Right. But she came forward. She had this very believable story. And that all came out on a Saturday. The Vitter folks were ready for it and distributed a bunch of information to discredit her. This story takes another weird turn, which I will get to in a minute. But, you know, we had to make a decision in my newsroom. And honestly, I wasn't part of the decision. I was kind of just the person who would have executed it about whether we were going to cover this or not. Do you acknowledge that someone is out there saying these kind of fanciful things? Because there's video of them out there on the internet. Or do you act like that's not happening because you can't verify that it's happening?
Or do you report something and say, this is what is out there and this is,
right.
but we can't verify this.
Right.
And then try to break it down as these are questionable right. sources.
So people handled it very differently. The Alt Weekly in New Orleans, which is called Gambit, initially reported it and linked out to Jason's blog. And Clancy, who along with his wife runs Gambit, Clancy Dubois, he reported it sort of matter-of-factly and then came back through when the Vitter people got to him and sort of qualified a bunch of it. She was in jail during some of this time that she says she had a relationship with him. He was already in Washington, so there's reasons to have doubts other than the, you know, we and the other major newspaper, I'm sorry, the other two major newspapers in New Orleans, Gannett owns a bunch of, I'm sorry, not in New Orleans, in Louisiana. Gannett owns a bunch of papers, smaller papers around the state. They didn't do anything about it. The Advocate, which is in Baton Rouge primarily, but also in New Orleans and Lafayette, didn't report on it. And then we didn't report on it until then you get a situation where we were trying to discuss what happens if one of these groups pulls this video and puts it up in an ad. What happens with one of these if one of these groups, and this is what happened, what happens if a candidate brings it up in a debate, mm-hmm. which is what happened. A candidate didn't bring up the pregnancy directly, but said, you guys should go to AmericanZombie.com and look at this stuff about David Vitter. He brought it up in the final debate. And at that point, I actually wasn't writing about that debate. My coworker Kevin was, but Kevin put the information at the bottom of a story and didn't link out to it, kind of referenced the website. Our competitor put the information at the top of the story and like kind of went into it. But our competitor also had someone on David Vitter and prostitution stuff, I think mostly full time, this investigative reporter, and he couldn't verify anything. So, I mean, that is an interesting journalism question. When something's not true and it's pretty explosive, like even just talking about him having a love child with a prostitute is pretty...
Well, it's so weird because in and of itself, whether it's true or not, it's part of the political dialogue that's going on. And it, you know, his campaign's going to have to react and the other campaigns are going to have to react.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so then, you know, if you're a journalist and you can't verify the mm-hmm. veracity of this accusation, I mean, how do you play it? I mean, do you, again, it's an element of the debate and an
right.
element of the discussion. You know, how do you ethically reference it? Or, I mean, you can't ignore it because
right.
it's part of what everybody's
right.
focused on and so much of the dialogue. I mean, you know, I guess from a journalist's perspective in an ideal situation, you would put all your resources into verifying the whether it's true or not, and then, you know, explain it as clearly as possible what you can and you can't verify.
Right.
And then, but then, you know, you could write, because of the way things are now in the political debate is you're ending up writing stories about not the actual thing, but of the reaction to the thing and how people are spinning it or not spinning it or what impact it's going to have. And so all this, you're generations away from the actual truth, whatever the truth is of the story.
Right. I would say what we did was when it came up, we covered it. There's most of the mainstream media, and I'm including local TV in that, and the student newspaper at LSU, for that matter. When it came up, we covered it. In our case, when it came up, we covered it, but we didn't bring it up pretty much otherwise. This specific thing, not prostitution, which we know, you know, well, we don't know, but...
Strongly suspect.
Right. I think the AP, I'm sorry, there are other, you know, New York Times, AP, there are other entities that were covering it that handled the AP, I think, when they wrote that debate story where the other candidate brought it up, completely ignored it. I mean, decided internally that they weren't going to write about it. So we had the three main entities who covered the debate from a print perspective, The Advocate, The Times-Picayune, and the AP all handled it differently. We put it at the bottom of the story. The Advocate put that incident at the top of the story. The AP chose to act like it didn't happen. So,
well, what did the public think? I mean, it was a general sense that the public.
I don't think there's a sense that the public really knew that this happened. The chattering class knew. I think people.
That's us.
The political class knew, and that, depending on which side of the issue you were, kind of shaped at least the response I was getting. So my paper had endorsed David Vitter, which I didn't have anything to do with as a reporter. You know, I'm not on the editorial board. I didn't even know until the editorial came out. But when we weren't covering this, it was like a tsunami of anger at me on Twitter about how I must not be covering it because we endorsed him. The Advocate doesn't endorse people, but they got similar angry responses. And then one of the Advocate reporters was talking a lot to Jason Bradbury, who's the blogger who put this up out there. And when they ended up not covering it, I get the sense that people who knew that this reporter was talking to this blogger a lot about this story got very upset, you know, that they didn't pick up the story, you know, very, very upset. So it's hard to explain to people, you know. I mean, Jason Bradbury, who put the information out there, I talked to him for a long time. He had been working on this stuff for years, literally years, trying to find more information about Vitter and prostitutes. And he said straight up, you know, I have different standards than you do for what I have to put out there. And I also know more. Like he says he knows more that verifies that this is actually the case, that she had his love child. The problem is we don't know that. I haven't seen a birth certificate. I haven't seen any evidence that she gave a child up for adoption, let alone that it was this sitting U.S. senator's child who is in a very contested race and who has a lot of people who don't like him who are trying to make sure he doesn't win. So,
yeah, I mean, if you're a blogger and your reason for your doing things is trying to verify whether a person is, you know, employed prostitutes and has a history of it, and you're actively going out and trying to find that evidence, you know, like it or not, that person has made a decision about the veracity or lack of veracity about what they're looking for.
Right. Yeah.
That whereas you as a representative of the quote unquote mainstream media, you know, your job isn't out there to go and say, well, I want to go see if I can find this evidence to prove it. I mean, obviously you want to find the truth of whatever the story is. And, you know, if you can prove this, I mean, but that shouldn't be your only driving thing. You have so many other considerations in covering an election story.
Right. So it's not clear how much of the public knew about that specific thing. He got asked about it a couple times during the runoff on TV, like about, I'm thinking of one New Orleans station. He did a live interview and they asked about this, you know, pregnancy prostitute story. And I'm sure there are other cases, but there wasn't like, I think, honestly, this is somewhat of the power still of the mainstream media. Because the mainstream media largely didn't pick it up, I think that a lot of the PACs that would have run ads alluding to this couldn't or didn't. Even though you're allowed to say a lot of things about a public official or a public person, which certainly an elected official who's in the U.S. Senate is, there are some limits to what broadcast will do or a TV station will allow you to run. Most of the prostitution ads that we saw in the runoff when it was just the Democrat and David Vitter did not reference these new allegations. They focused on the previous allegations or, for example, John Bel Edwards ran an ad. He's a West Point grad and a vet, and he ran an ad talking about how, you know, he, you know, jumped out of planes. But David Vitter, who may or may not have been on the phone at some point during a day when he was supposed to take a vote on veterans issues, he was maybe his phone records show he was calling the DC madam. So that's like a new angle to a old story, right? But they didn't really go there with the pregnancy and the adoption stuff. They also didn't have to. I mean, they were in a pretty good position because a lot of damage had been done to him. So
let's talk about, I mean, the election occurs, the runoff occurs, and then there's this what a lot of people call an upset. So what impact does that have
from a journal?
Were you surprised?
I wasn't surprised by the time the election happened, although I still, so, you know, we can also talk about polling. You know, I don't like covering polls. I'm sure a lot of political people do. It's frustrating because you don't know how reliable they are. Now, in this case, we were lucky because every poll that came out showed John Bel ahead. And initially, when those were happening in September, it was like, this is an anomaly. People are going to realize he's a Democrat and they're going to, I mean, I had a legislator who told me he kept hearing, oh, I really like that John Bel Edwards guy. John Bel ran a great campaign. He was totally unknown to most of the state. He ran a great campaign where he did lots of ads highlighting his military service, you know, West Point grad. His dad was a sheriff. His brother's now the sheriff. He did absolutely one of the best political ads I've ever seen. He's against abortion, and he did this ad featuring his wife where she talked about how their first child was born with spina bifida and they were advised to terminate the pregnancy and that they were devastated, but they are really religious people and they were never going to opt for an abortion, and now their daughter's getting married and she's engaged, and you know, it was like a very wonderfully constructed ad that I'm sure made people cry. Louisiana is very Catholic. I think that he hit a real home run with that one in presenting himself as, yes, I'm a Democrat, but I'm conservative and I have values like yours.
Yeah, that may be something that a lot of people who, especially maybe people who are outside our country, who they think Republicans, Democrats, they think that if you look at the national stage, that means one thing. But, you know, you and I knew this from when we were covering Northern Virginia and the state of Virginia, that, you know, Southern Democrats are very different than Democrats around that D doesn't mean quite the same thing
right.
as it does in Massachusetts and Minnesota.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, I think that one of the things are, you know, a lot of people do a lot of polling, but there are standards, and I personally would like to go by, and I've had different bosses who have had different opinions about this. I would like to go by their pointer, and the New York Times has standards about polls that they'll run, not in the aggregate. I'm not talking about like 538 Nate Silver using an algorithm to look at all the polls and weighting all of them and kind of coming up with, okay, this is what they're all saying en masse.
Sort of like a weatherman.
Right. Yeah. It's very hard when you're presented with an individual poll and you're like, this poll shows a Democrat who we didn't think would ever win statewide in Louisiana again ahead by 15 points. Do I believe this poll? And so I really think that newsrooms have to have a standard going into an election. Like, what are we going to run in terms of polls as standalone stories? And in our case, it was like, we wanted it to be a media poll or a poll by a university, basically, because usually other private polls, and there are tons, are being paid for by some interested party, either a campaign or sometimes it's just like a group of wealthy people who are trying to figure out who they want to give money to. Mm-hmm. But you don't really know what those people's motivations are. Are they, you know, whatever.
Or if you're just relying on their interpretation of what this poll says.
Right. So in this case, by the time the election happened, I wasn't surprised. I don't think anyone was surprised because John Bell, literally in every poll that happened during the runoff, regardless of which entity it was, as far as we could tell, was leading. But in the primary, I have to admit that I saw a lot of those polls and I was like, what is going on here? You know? And then we had experts at LSU and elsewhere telling us, you know, look, polls about elections months out can't really tell you what's going to happen, especially when it's this type of thing, because people will flirt with the Democrat because they don't really like the Republican. But at the end of the day, what people told me was they'll come home. They'll be like, hey, I'm in the voting booth and I don't, you know.
Ooh. I can't bring myself right to vote for a Democrat.
And he's not getting hammered because the Republicans are all trying to vie for that second spot. So no one's like Obama, Obama, John Bel Edwards, Obama, which actually there was like a whole website set up called John Bel Edwards, Obama. So, I think that that is a difficult question. As I said, the New York Times and Pointer have standards. They're very high standards. The poll has to like include cell phones. You know, the poll has to include live people. They won't run a robo poll. The poll has to, you know, there are a lot of things like, whereas someone like Nate Silver, who has a skill set that I wish I had, but I don't have, he has the ability to wait like a robocall poll, which is traditionally considered a lot less reliable, kind of figure out how that weights and how often is this relevant. And maybe 4 days out from the election, a robocall poll actually isn't all that inaccurate, but, you know, a few months out. So that was a struggle. I had competitors who were running posts that got a lot of traffic that said, you know, John Bel Edwards is way ahead. We had one group of businessmen that really wanted Scott Angel to win. And so they were always, their pollster wouldn't release his crosstabs all the time. And like he wouldn't show us all the questions he asked in the poll and stuff because they were a private group and they didn't want that out there. And yeah, I mean, that was kind of a question like on a weekly basis, people are going to click on a story about a poll, especially one that shows a Democrat far ahead, because it's like, what, you know, but
because that's unusual,
but people. Should you run that if you think that the poll is
right
not accurate? Now I would say no. Some other people, and I think that there's a legitimate reason to think this, would say, well, if I wrote a story and I qualify it and I tell people like, look, this is an internet poll or what, you know, then why shouldn't I be able to run it? So
yeah, the thing I hate about a lot of political coverage during elections, it's very much like sports coverage.
Yeah.
That they're really, you know, at the end of the day, the only story is game day. What, you know, who right. wins, who loses. But then you have all these other days that you have to cover things. Mm-hmm. And so you're constantly trying to predict, you know, oh, is this, you know, is this person injured? Is this, mm-hmm. you know, how, you know, what decision is going to happen because this happened last week? And, you know, there's so much of that that goes on in the political arena mm-hmm. where, you know, the journalist is going out there and they're trying to, you know, you're the political reporter. You know, what are you covering today when there is no news? I mean, well, maybe you do turn to a poll and said, oh, this poll is telling us something completely mm-hmm. different. Then it's like, well, do you cover it just because it's the only piece of news that you got? I mean, just because covering it gives it greater weight?
Right.
Yeah. I don't know.
And people have different audiences. We have a local political publication called La Politics in Louisiana, and Jeremy's audience, Jeremy Alford runs it. He's great. His audience understands polling better than my audience does. So, you know. His audience has more of an idea of like what this actually means in September than my audience does, you know. That yeah, I mean it's a difficult question, and I know that pollsters, I will say like high level pollsters who do this, you know, really regularly. I mean, I'm not talking anyone at Gallup, but I'm, you know, people in Louisiana who are like have been doing this for a long time. They are very frustrated with the media and how polls are covered because they feel like people don't really understand what they're looking at. It is the long and the short of it. So, but you know, I do think that there's, so I come down on the more conservative side. I do think there's a really legitimate argument that says this information is out there. We've got, I talked about one blog, but we got a blog called The Hayride that is a conservative blog that like almost everyone in the political realm goes to. The information is also out there. Like just because you and then this is a new media problem or struggle, you're in the mainstream media just because you ignore something doesn't mean other people aren't writing about it.
It's going to have an impact in some way, yeah. Part of the discussion.
Right, yeah. So, you know, we're not the gatekeepers.
No, we're not. Right. We're not the gatekeepers.
And that's a good thing, you know, I think.
I do too. Part of our role is to, you know, sift through all of the different voices that are out there and try to come up with the legitimate truth, whatever that is, mm-hmm. and deliver it and message to your readers and be a source where they can trust you, that you're not just a shill mm-hmm. for one particular party or bent. Now that the election's over and you're going to have a new governor, what do you see the big issues coming up in Louisiana politics?
Oh gosh. Well, there are a couple things. Our state is in a financial crisis. Louisiana and Kansas and probably Illinois. Kansas and Louisiana for similar reasons. Illinois for its own special reasons are in financial situations that are like my understanding is the worst in the country. Certainly Kansas and Louisiana are. I think Illinois is perpetually kind of in a bad way. A lot of that has to do with various things, but kind of a bunch of things happen at once. Our governor did a lot of funny things to keep the budget afloat without having to drastically cut services or raise revenue because he had been planning to run for president for a long time. So I know to outside people, he was like this minor candidate, but he did a lot of things in the state to prepare for running for president, including not considering raising taxes, even when we were facing sort of the closure of universities and stuff last year. He sold off some state property to help cover our basic bills. He drained some trust funds. So like the trust fund that helps state employee insurance kind of become solvent, you know, got drained to help cover budget problems in other ways. So we're kind of at the end of the rope there. We don't have any money in Louisiana, and there are going to be some really tough decisions. In fact, we don't have any money right now. Like, we've had the fiscal year started in July. We've had two budget shortfalls in the current fiscal year. And I'm sorry. I should also say out of control of any of the governor or any other politician is that oil prices, Louisiana, when the oil market tanks, it's really bad for our state. So, you know, it's kind of both of those things coming together are not helping us. So we have the new governor is going to come in, and it's there's some serious problems. We have to have a special session before we go into our regular legislative session just to deal with the current fiscal shortfall. Like, how are we going to make the books work by June 30th? They had a $500 million problem already that they resolved, but not really. And we have a huge shortfall in Medicaid. There are just more people using Medicaid. We don't have Medicaid expansion yet. That's a big change. Our new governor, that's the other thing I was going to get to. One will be just fiscal issues, and then our new governor campaigned on Medicaid expansion, and that's happening. So that'll be a huge issue. I think that even the conservative Louisiana legislature is on board to do that. I think most states are. I know Virginia's not done it yet, but it's a lot of money that you're leaving on the table. And in our case, we have a poor state, so there are a lot of medical services that the state provides because people just don't have insurance, you know, that Medicaid expansion would help cover the cost for. And it's so much money to leave on the table. So, and our governor believes that's the right thing to do. It's something he has always believed in. He's been in the legislature for a long time. So, but yeah, we have a lot of financial issues, really bad financial issues. We already have like maybe as much as a $2 billion shortfall in the budget next year because our governor, again, was using all this kind of, he'd find extra funds in the, like, you know, clean hunting areas, you know, extra money in these like little funds where he was kind of pulling from wherever he could, the couch cushions basically, to help keep the budget afloat. But now we can't do that anymore. So now we're really faced with
you're forced to make some hard choices.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, sadly, but from a journalistic perspective, you'll have plenty of things to write about, sadly. But it sounds pretty fascinating now that you're not covering the election and now you get to actually get back into the state house. This has been great, and I'm glad you came in and we had a chance to get caught up and talk about Louisiana politics. Where can people find your stories online?
Yeah, so our website, our company's name is NOLA.com. You can go there to find stuff. My Twitter handle is J.S. O'Donohue, so that's J.S.O.D.O.N.O.G.H.U.E. I tweet a lot.
Is that unusual for the state house down there?
It was. Congress. When I first got there, so for journalists who are not in sports or politics, we tweet a lot, especially if you're like a beat reporter.
Mm-hmm.
So it was for a little bit when I got down there. It was kind of surprising. I got down there and the AP reporter tweeted, but y'all may know other AP reporters. They are very. They sort of are very direct in their tweeting, I guess would be the way I would put it.
Sure.
There's not a whole lot of color, just like the AP. There's not a whole lot of color. It's very you better be tweeting something that's right. I don't want anyone to think I'm not tweeting something that's right. But they have very strict rules about
sure
what they can do on social media. So the AP reporter was tweeting. And and is a good friend of mine and a good person to follow. She was tweeting. There was one person in the Advocate office that was tweeting. Now that's very much changed. Everyone at my competitor was forced to get on Twitter, and they had a new staffer come in who is a very prolific, just social media person in general. And had come from Missouri and just had a different approach. But yeah, I think now it is. And I would say we have more. I worked in Virginia with Mike, and Louisiana was a little bit behind, but now we have more elected officials who are also on Twitter. I mean, for a while, that was also another, you know, it's funny because we think there's this whole conversation going on. Particularly during session, you're tweeting all day about what's happening, but then the people we cover, not, you know, they're not in that conversation. Well, now it's a little different. especially in the House. Like a few of the conservative House members got on Twitter and have started telling other House members about what is being said on Twitter. And so there, we've got more people on. And I will say this, I hope they don't get mad at me. A lot of state government workers have gotten on Twitter in the last, people who work in the Capitol.
No, people who are not elected. Maybe
right. So I suspect
hired.
At the U.S. Capitol that like every staff member is on Twitter. That was not true in Louisiana until recently. They don't tend to tweet, but they are definitely following you because I work in the Capitol. My office is in the Capitol and they will come in like, if I tweet about not having an umbrella and it raining, they will like come and... say something about it. But I think that that's all catching on a lot more down there. You know, we're talking about people who tend to be older, elected mm-hmm. officials or not, young guns. And also people who, even in the Capitol, a lot of people who just tend to be older. But I think I find with sports and politics is very similar. You're tweeting pretty much all the time. You know, yeah. I don't know how helpful that is. And I definitely have friends who have hidden me because they don't need that in their feed all day. But, you know, so.
Okay. Well, I follow you. So it's always always cool to see what you got going on. So, again, thanks for coming in. It's always great to see and talk to you about the wonderful world of Louisiana politics.
Mm-hmm.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of digital news. This week's podcast was produced by Michael O'Connell, Amber Healy, and Nicole Ogrisco. Find out more about us and download past episodes at itsalljournalism.com. You can also subscribe to It's All Journalism on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and now Spreaker. Today's podcast is brought to you by Tape-A-Call, a super valuable tool for journalists and professionals looking to record crystal clear calls on their smartphones. We spoke to the folks over at Tape-A-Call and learned that it's actually the number one business app for the iPhone in over 30 countries. Tape-A-Call lets you easily record your incoming and outgoing calls, as well as share your recordings with colleagues, interviewees, and through social media. It's the perfect tool for recording phone interviews. Tape-A-Call keeps people honest and accountable and ensures that you never miss an important detail for a story. Over 3 million professionals, including local news journalists and even CNN producers, trust Tape-A-Call on a day-to-day basis. Visit tapeacall.com/podcast today and experience the easiest, most reliable, and convenient call recording app available. It's All Journalism listeners can get Tape-A-Call at an exclusive 20% off discount by visiting tapeacall.com/podcast. It's All Journalism is produced in partnership with the Association of Alternative News Media. It's All Journalism is also a member of the DC Podcasters community. Look for us on Facebook. Thanks for listening.